Last week we saw that soon after David defeated Goliath and became the hero for Israel, he was invited in and brought into the household of the king. And very quickly he became very good friends, in fact blood brother friends, in fact just the closest kind of friends that you could imagine, with the king's son, with Jonathan. And we saw that love, the love between David and Jonathan and Jonathan and David. And we talked about that last time. Today we're going to go on in our story. We'll pick up where we left off. We went through chapter 20 of 1 Samuel last time, and we'll pick up in chapter 21. To kind of feed us in there, we talked about Jonathan's relationship and what Jonathan thought of David. We talked about that last time. What about his dad? How did his father, King Saul, how did he feel about David when he first met him? Go back to 1 Samuel 16, verse 21. And this is in the section where we see that Saul, after God left him, after God's spirit departed from him, God allowed evil spirits to come in and torment Saul. And when he did, they brought in musicians to kind of soothe and to play for him. And it's in that section that talks about that in verse 21, David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. Then Saul sent word to Jesse, saying, "Allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him." So you see that Saul liked David when he first met him. He was recruited as a musician, and Saul liked him very much and wanted him to stay in his service. And we see that David kind of went back and forth a little bit until after David defeated Goliath. So once David defeated Goliath, David then joined Saul's army, joined the army of the Israelites. And how did God bless David then? Chapter 18, verse 2 says, "From that day Saul kept David with him and would not let him return to his father's house. Whatever Saul sent David to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well." So God gave David success in everything. And David excelled. That pleased everyone, including Saul. You see that Saul gave him high positions in the army and promoted him as he went on. Now eventually, though, the army came back home. That is Saul's home. And when they did, we see verses 6 kind of changes things of chapter 18. "When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands.'" Now we see Saul. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They've credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands? What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that day on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. And that's what we see for the rest of Saul's reign. Saul is disturbed. He's tormented by the evil spirits. But the biggest evil spirit that he's got, the biggest trouble that he's got, is his jealousy. Okay? Is his paranoia of David. Does he have anything to be afraid of with David? Well, word eventually gets out, and people realize that God has chosen David to be the next king. Saul has been told that God has rejected him and has chosen someone, a neighbor of his, who will be better than him. So Saul knows that someone's going to take the kingship, and he doesn't want that to happen. And when it becomes clear that that person is David, it looks like Saul has something to fear. Watch that as we go through our story today. Does Saul have something to fear from David? Okay. Well, we see that he's jealous from this time on, and it just continues to grow and grow. Even early on, we see how serious it gets. Just the next verses. The next day, so just right then, as soon as he gets jealous of David, the very next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him. Now, it wasn't an accident, because David eluded him twice. Okay, he did it a couple of times. So he just tried to just throw spears at him and tried target practice with David. That's how seriously jealous he was. Well, he realized that he's a lousy shot with a spear. So what did he do to try to get rid of this kid who was receiving more praise than he was? Going on in chapter 18, we'll jump a few verses here. Verse 13, it says that, I'll start at 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. Okay, that's the bottom line here. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaign. So here you see that he put David in control of troops, as he already had, but here he sent him away. Okay, at least let me get him out of my sight. Okay, but we see that in everything he did, he had great success. And then in verse 15, when Saul saw how successful David was, he was afraid of him. But all of Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaign. So, you see, it just keeps getting worse. Everyone loves this guy. Okay, it's kind of like everyone loves Raymond, and the brother is Saul, just jealous all the time and getting worse. And every time God gives David success, Saul gets more and more jealous. So then in verse 17, Saul said to David, "Here's my older daughter Merib. I give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." Okay, so it looks like he likes David like everybody else does, and he's rewarding David by letting him become a prince, by letting him become part of the royal family. But his motive was, for Saul said to himself, "I won't raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." By making David a son-in-law, that painted a big red target on David, and the Philistines would be a prize for them to capture, a prize for them to kill. So Saul said, "Okay, we'll just paint a target on him, and that'll take care of him." But in David's humility, David would not accept and didn't feel like he deserved to become a son-in-law of the king. So he refused to marry Merib. Well, then later in verse 20, it says Saul's daughter Michal, well, Merib was married to someone else in verse 19, and then verse 20, Michal was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. He said, "I'll give her to him so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hands of the Philistines may be against him." Okay, I got a second shot here. So he said to David, "I got a second shot." No, he said, "Now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law." Okay, so here he's again looking for the Philistines to take care of the problem here, putting him into a risky situation, into a risky position here. David again was humble. Saul worked on him and had people comment to him and say, "Hey, the king is really pleased with you. You really ought to marry his daughter because he wants you to be a son-in-law." And he said, "Well, I can't afford that. I can't afford the bride price." And so then Saul said, "Okay, well, here's another opportunity." He says, "Okay, I do want a bride price, but the only bride price I want are the foreskins of 100 Philistines." Well, Philistines don't give those up very easily. So Saul's thought is, okay, in the process of him trying to do this, he'll get killed. Well, he wasn't. In fact, he killed 200 Philistines and brought that bride price to Saul. So none of that worked. Okay, it says Saul's plan in verse 25 was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. Okay, so his first attempt to try to get rid of this threat that he saw was to pin David to the wall, and that didn't work. He's a lousy shot. So then he thought, "Well, let me just paint a big target on him for the Philistines," and that didn't work. Okay, verse 30, it says, "The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle as they often did. David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known." So the whole Philistine target thing became even a worse problem, because David did go out to battle and fight against the Philistines, but God granted him great success when he did so. And that made the people love him all the more, and that made Saul jealous all the more. So we see chapter 18 here, that's what its focus is Saul's jealousy of David. But you know, it doesn't stop at the end of chapter 18. It continues on, and we see that for the rest of Saul's life. Saul is possessed. He's overpossessed by this jealousy of David. Well, what about his son? Okay, we've seen so far that we talked last week about the love that Jonathan had for David. Well, what's the next approach? We'll see Jonathan in this. What's the next approach that Saul takes? If I can't kill him, if I'm a lousy shot, if the Philistines aren't going to get him, what's the next thing? Chapter 19, it says, "Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David." Okay, so he put out a hit order on David. The problem is that Jonathan was very fond of David and warned David. He said, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there." And so Jonathan protected David and warned David about the threat and allowed David to get away. Okay? So Dad's trying to get rid of this guy, but Jonathan doesn't want to because that's his best friend. They're close friends, and Saul and Jonathan has a great love for David. Well, Jonathan, we then see in chapter 19, we saw that he stood up to Saul for David. And how does Saul respond? Verse 6, Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath: "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." Okay? You're right, Jonathan. I'm wrong. He hasn't done anything to offend me. God's blessing him. I shouldn't be upset by that. I won't put him to death. As surely as God lives, he makes this oath to God that he will not try to kill David. But then, just a few verses later, well, we get verses, verse 8, David gets more success. That adds more jealousy to Saul. Verses 9 and 10, you have another, let's try the spear thing again. And that didn't work. Saul still missed him. And then verse 11, Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. So he sent assassins out to get rid of David. Okay, but this time it wasn't Jonathan. This time it was his daughter, Michal, David's wife, warned him and said, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed." And she protected David. So Saul, his whole life is possessed with trying to get rid of David, but his children are doing everything they can to protect David. Now we see this time when he sent the assassins out and was making efforts to kill David, this time he learned his lesson from earlier and he did not tell Jonathan, okay? Because Jonathan would just go protect David, and he knew better. He knew not to let Jonathan know what was going on. So David runs away. He flees. And where does he go? To whom does David turn when he's faced with this new threat? Let's turn to Psalm 59. And this is a psalm that David wrote at this time, when Saul had met, if you look at the heading of Psalm 59, when Saul had sent men to watch David's house in order to kill him. David says, "Deliver me from my enemies, O God. Protect me against those who rise up against me. Deliver me from evildoers and save me from bloodthirsty men. See how they lie in wait for me? Fierce men conspire against me. For no offense or sin of mine, O Lord, I've done no wrong, yet they're ready to attack me." And he goes on and on like that. Verse 17, "O my strength, I sing praise to you, O God. You are my fortress, my loving God." So to whom does David turn when his back's up against the wall, when he's being pursued by assassins and his life's on the line? He turns to God. He looks to God for protection, and he writes this song to God. Okay? Now, he writes this song, he turns to God, and he also then goes, we saw in at the end of verse 19 and verse 18, it says, when David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah. Okay? Samuel, the prophet of God, who's still around at this time. And, Saul finds out that David's at Ramah. What does Saul do? Well, Saul sends a group of assassins to go kill David at Ramah. He's a sitting duck. Well, those assassins get there, and they start prophesying like the prophets. Saul hears about that, so he sends another group. Same thing happens. Saul hears about it, he sends a third group. Same thing happens again. Who's protecting David here? God is protecting David. Well, Saul says, okay, if you can't trust someone else to do it right, you got to do it yourself. So he goes, he gets there to Ramah, and he starts prophesying. And God protects David, and then David gets away from Ramah. So you see, God sent his spirit to Saul and his men to protect David. And so you see, the one to whom David turned is the one who could do something about it, God. Same one that we're called to turn to when we have tough times, when we feel like we're being attacked. Okay, well, David then went back, while Saul was at Ramah, David went back to Kish, Jonathan, and told Jonathan, what's going on? Okay, chapter 20, He said, what have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to kill me? Never, Jonathan said. You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so. Dad's not planning to kill you. He didn't tell me that. If he was trying to kill you, he'd tell me. He told me before. We got that straightened out. And I've heard nothing of this. You don't know what you're talking about, David. And David goes, well, I hate to tell you, Jonathan, but I do. And he is trying to kill me. And he just didn't want to tell you because he knew that you would protect me. So here, let me prove it to you. And he sets up this thing and says, and we've read that story a couple of times in chapter 20. And he sets up this situation, and sure enough, it plays out just as David said. And that is proof to Jonathan. And not only is it proof to Jonathan that that his dad wanted to kill David, but it went even beyond the proof. We see later in chapter 20 that when Jonathan stood up and defended David to his dad Saul, in verse 30, Saul's anger flares up at Jonathan and says, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Okay, it's not talking about his mom, that's talking about him. Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? And here we see Saul thinks it's obvious, Jonathan, you need to want him dead too, because as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die. Okay? So I'm trying to do this for your sake, Jonathan. I'm trying to protect the crown for you, the kingdom for you. And as long as this David guy's around, you're not going to get to be king. Okay? He's the threat to our dynasty. He's the threat to our royal family. Jonathan's response to that, well, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul was so upset by this and upset that Jonathan would defend David that Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. He tried to kill his own son. He tried to kill the heir apparent. He tried to kill the guy that he supposedly was protecting the kingdom for. But it wasn't that. It was himself. It was his jealousy for himself that Saul was upset with David. And Jonathan then knew that his father really, really intended to kill David. Okay? So Jonathan went and informed David of that and allowed David to get away. Now, Saul, again, you see he acted like he was concerned about Jonathan, but shouldn't Jonathan be concerned about that? Shouldn't Jonathan realize that David is going to be the next king and or is in line to be the next king and as such is a threat to him and his future? Well, go on further to chapter 23. Just look at verse 17. This is when David is in hiding. Jonathan comes to him and gives him some comfort as a friend. And then Jonathan says, don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. Even though he wants to, and he's doing everything he can to try to, and we'll see that. He says, you will be king over Israel, and I'll be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. So Jonathan knew that God had chosen David to be the next king. Jonathan didn't fight that. He accepted that because it's God's will. And he didn't see that as a threat to him. He saw that his relationship with David to where he would be the second in command. And so Jonathan didn't recognize a threat here like his father did. Why? Because Jonathan saw God's will and recognized God's will and accepted God's will, where Saul was just the opposite. And Saul was focused on his own will and didn't recognize and didn't follow God's will. Okay, so David then gets away again. Where does David go? Now this is where we pick it up. Okay, we've just kind of recapped where we've been so far. Before, when David ran away, he ran north, not too far north, but he ran north to Ramah, where Samuel was. So did he go to Samuel again here? Chapter 21. David went to Nob, okay? Big city of Nob, right? Well, you don't hear much of Nob, but you do hear in this story, very important story, because that's where the high priest was, okay? He went to Nob to Ahimelech, the high priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him. He said, okay, what are you doing here, David? Why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Okay? Word had spread that there's not a lot of friendship between Saul and David there. That people knew that Saul was, and they really know it later on, but now they know there's this jealousy, and word's gotten out that, that Saul is jealous of David. And when David shows up to the high priest all by himself, he's going, okay, what's going on? You know, are you in the Alps with Saul? Is there a coup? What's, you know, so Ahimelech is nervous. But David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king charged me with a certain matter and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I've told them to meet me at a certain place.'" Okay, so David lies here. Why does he lie? Is this saying it's good to lie? Now again, David is a sinful person just like we are. We'll talk more about his sins in a couple of weeks here. But one thing that David is probably doing here is he's trying to protect Ahimelech. That Ahimelech doesn't know, there's no need for Ahimelech to know what the situation really is, and then either turn on David or be forced to take sides and create a problem for Ahimelech. So he makes this story up that that Saul had sent him on this special mission, secret mission here, okay? But he also says, though, verse 3, "Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." Okay, David didn't have any food, so he asked Ahimelech for some food. And there's also something else. He's running. He's leaving. He has nothing. So he asks for some food. And then he also asks in verse 8, he says, "Don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's business was urgent." Okay, so he also asked for any kind of weapons that the high priest might have. Well, what kind of weapons might the high priest have? Well, we'll see that in a minute. By the way, Ahimelech was Eli. You remember Eli? He was the great high priest who was in office when Samuel was called and when Samuel was a baby. And then Samuel kind of took over there. Even though Samuel was not a high priest, Samuel was God's prophet and God's interface. But Eli's descendancy still continued to be the high priest. If you remember the command or the punishment that God pronounced on Eli and his descendants because Eli's sons were wicked and Eli didn't stop them from being wicked, he said that you will not have an old person in your descendancy anymore. All of your descendants will die young. So Ahimelech was Eli's great-grandson, probably young, okay, because of that pronouncement there. So Ahimelech's a little nervous here because David's showing up. So was Ahimelech able to give David any food? Well, I'll start at verse 4. Ahimelech answered David, "I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here. But you know, I don't know if I should give it to you. Well, provided that the men have kept themselves from women, okay? As long as they're clean, then maybe I can give you the consecrated bread." David replied, "Well, indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's things are holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?" So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except for the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day that it was taken away. Okay, so he gave him consecrated bread. What was consecrated bread? And by the way, this, by knowing that, we know what day this was. If you turn back to Leviticus chapter 24, verse 8 says, and it talks about, start to verse 5, and it talks about baking 12 loaves of bread. And this bread is to be set out before the Lord regularly in the temple, okay, or in the tent of tabernacle, Sabbath after Sabbath on behalf of the Israelites as a lasting covenant. So the covenant bread was bread that was baked, 12 loaves, one for each tribe, and it was set on it was called showbread, and set on the showbread table, there in the temple or the tent of tabernacle at this time, and every Sabbath, okay, every Saturday. And what they would do is on the Sabbath, they would go and they would remove the old bread that had been sitting there all week and put the new fresh, hot bread there for God. Okay? The old bread, well, it's a week old, but is not too bad, and the priest could eat it. That was the only bread that Ahimelech had. And he was hesitant to give it to David because it's God's, but David had the need, and so he gave it to him. Jesus talks about this. Okay, back in Matthew, when Jesus is having discussions with Pharisees and others who are... Well, let's just look at that. Matthew chapter 12, you see the story. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. Okay, so they're walking on the Sabbath, and they just grab some grains ahead and pop the seeds out and eat them. The Pharisees saw this and said, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." What were they doing? Well, it was threshing. Okay, they were harvesting wheat, even though it was just a few grains. But that fell under the Pharisee definition of work and working on the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, keep it separate. Don't do any work on the Sabbath. And they say, "Your disciples are working on the Sabbath." Jesus answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests." Okay? So he uses this example to say, well, what does he have to say? Go down to verse 12, and he concludes it, and he says, "Therefore it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." And in a lot of his discussions and explanations, Jesus says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Pharisees had put all these rules about what you could and could not do. You couldn't walk beyond a certain distance on the Sabbath, or that was called work. You couldn't have any implement of your labor on your body. Like if you were a tailor and you happened to have a needle in your pocket, that was work because you were carrying an implement of your labor. Okay? And they made the Sabbath a painful day for people because of all the rules they had. And Jesus said, no, the Sabbath was made for man. It's a day of rest. It's a day of celebration and enjoyment, a day to remember Yahweh and to worship Him. It's not a day to worry about all these rules and laws and regulations. And okay, man, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, Jesus says. And so he uses this example here of David at Nob eating this consecrated bread. Yes, it was unlawful for David to take and eat the consecrated bread, but there was greater need there. And how much better, you know, when Jesus heals the hand of the man whose hand is shriveled on the Sabbath, okay, is it not right to do good on the Sabbath and to take care of people's needs? He gets some food. He had asked Ahimelech for some food. He also had asked him, we saw, in verse 8, for some weapons. Did the priest have any kind of weapons? Verse 9, the priest replied, "Well, there is the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah. It's here. It's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There's no sword here but that one." David said, "Oh, there's none like it. Give it here." So, why would the priest have a weapon? Well, he doesn't have a weapon for a weapon's sake. He has the sword of Goliath that was the big sign of victory that God defeated the Philistines, and that was brought to the high priest and put in the Tent of Tabernacle here, or outside the Tent of Tabernacle. So, he got his food, he got a weapon, and then where did he go after leaving Nob? That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Where did he go? He went to the land of his enemies. He went to Gath, one of the five big cities of the Philistines. He went to live with the Philistines. Well, why would he do that? Well, for one thing, he's fairly protected. Saul's not going to pursue him there, and he can hide pretty well there. And on top of that, if you look at 1 Samuel 17, verse 4, you see that that's where Goliath was from. Here, he's got Goliath's sword, and he takes it back to Goliath's hometown. Kind of risky. People would recognize that, wouldn't you think? Well, by the way, had anybody seen David get these supplies? Verse 7. Now, one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. So Doeg, the head shepherd for Saul, saw David there getting the bread, getting the sword. Okay, So his visit to Nob wasn't secret here. Was David concerned that Saul would learn what he had done and pursue him? Well, let's look at Psalm 43. We don't know that David wrote this at this time, but this and many other psalms that David wrote are very similar and would fit into this time as well as other times that he's being pursued. Verse 1. Vindicate me, O God, and plead my cause against an ungodly nation. Rescue me from deceitful and wicked men. Your God, my stronghold, why have you rejected me? Why must I go about mourning and oppressed by the enemy? Send forth your light and your truth, and let them guide me. Let them bring me to your holy mountain, to the place where you dwell. And then I'll go to the altar of God, to God, my joy and my delight. I'll praise you with a harp, O my God. Why are you downcast, O my soul? Why have you so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my Savior and my God. So, he is concerned that Saul is going to pursue him and find out where he is. And so he writes psalms of praise, but really psalms are looking for refuge, looking for God to protect him, looking for God to take care of him. Okay. All right, so he shows up in Gath. How do the Philistines feel about David showing up in Gath? Verse 11. But the servants of Achish was the king of Gath, said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land?" You know, we've all heard he's going to be the king. "Isn't he the one that they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. Well, he should be, right? I mean, he is going to be the next king of the top enemy of the Philistines. Why would he think that he would be safe there? Well, what happens? What happens is that the Philistines then grab him and take him to King Achish. How does David respond to that? Well, let's go back to Psalm 56. And this, he did write this at this time when the Philistines had seized him in Gath. He says, "Be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. All day long they press their attack. But, verse 11, in God I trust. I will not be afraid. For what can man do to me?" He again turns to God. He turns to God to protect him. He puts his trust in God. He sings this song to God. So, how did David protect himself from this danger then? Verse 13, "So David pretended to be insane in their presence, and while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servant, 'Look at that man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short a madman that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?'" Okay, so he said, "Get rid of him. I don't care. Leave him alone. Just get him out of here. He's crazy. He's a madman." So David's skin was protected then. But what David did there was pretty risky. You know, Achish could just as easily have had him killed. How could David have had the guts to try something so risky? We turn to Psalm 34, and the note there under Psalm 34 says that David wrote this when he pretended to be insane before Abimelech, who drove him away, and he left. Abimelech was a name of, it's kind of like saying Pharaoh or Caesar. Abimelech means my father is king, or my father the king. And so it was a title. So even though the king's name was Achish, he would also have been called Abimelech. So chapter 34, he says, we'll just look at verse 4. "I sought the Lord, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears." And then verse 22, "The Lord redeems his servants. No one will be condemned who takes refuge in him." And you can read that whole psalm. But he sought God. He sought the Lord, and God delivered him. Okay? "Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you." And he went to God when he was captured and brought to Abimelech, and God protected him. And God gave him the protection through this acting of being insane. And David wrote this psalm in response. All right, well, okay. It's risky in Israel. It's risky to stay in Philistines. Eventually they're going to see that he's not really insane, so he can't really stay there in Gath. So where does he go? Chapter 22. David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers heard about it and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. Okay, so he went to the cave of Adullam. Now this is in the valley of Elah where he had fought and killed Goliath. Okay, so this valley, there's all these caves all around it, and so there's he went to one of these caves there in that valley. Now, his family eventually heard that he was there, and they came and joined him there. Before his family got there, to whom did he turn? In Psalm 57, it says that this is a psalm of David when he had fled from Saul into the cave. Verse 1 to 2, "Have mercy on me, O God, have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me." To whom did he turn? To whom did David always turn when he had troubles? He turned to God. To whom are we to turn when we have troubles? We're to turn to God. David provides us that example. The Psalms are recollections of the ways and some of the ways that David turned to God and the trust and faith that he had in God to protect him, to take care of him, and to be in control of the situation. All right, so David's family eventually joined up with him. Did anyone else come to David's support besides his family? Verse 2, "All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him." So all these other outcasts gathered around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him. Okay, so everyone else who didn't like Saul and was outcast for whatever reason joined up with him. And if you look at 1 Chronicles 11 and 12, you'll see some interesting stories about some of the men who joined David. Some of the mighty men of valor that that joined David and fought for him and fought with him and lived with him. Well, okay, David's got his family there with him, but you know, his family aren't fighting people, they're shepherds. And he wants to protect them, and he knows that one way that Saul might try to get to him is to get to his family, so he needs to be concerned about his family. And you know, if he's running around fighting, trying to escape Saul, he doesn't need to be worrying about the welfare of his family. He needs to have his family protected without him having them around. So what does he do to protect his family? Verse 3. "From there, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, 'Would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?' So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. But the prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah.' So David left and went to the forest of Hereth." So he went to Moab. He went to one of the other enemies. Remember, Saul had enemies all around, one of which was Moab. Well, an enemy of Saul's is an enemy of, is a friend of mine, is probably the approach here of the king of Moab. But there's more reason than that why David thought that he could seek asylum for his parents in Moab. If you turn back to Ruth, well, just a few scattered verses. In chapter 1, verse 22, it says that Naomi returned from Moab. Okay, remember this started out with a story of Naomi and Elimelech. And Elimelech died. That was her husband. They had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they both died while they were in Moab, but they both had had wives. And one of those wives that ended up coming back with Naomi from Moab was Ruth. Okay, and she was a Moabitess. She was from Moab. And then we see, as you go through the story, chapter 4, we see in verse 13 that Boaz, which was a relative of Naomi, okay, a Benjamite from Benjamin, or from Bethlehem, Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. So you see that Boaz marries this woman from Moab. But then, verse 17, it says, "The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son.'" She's got a grandson here. "And they named him Obed." Okay? So that's what this is all about, right? Well, Obed had a son named Jesse, and Jesse had a son named David. So, why did David go to Moab? Because his great-grandmother Ruth was a Moabitess. He had Moab blood in him. And so he looked to the king of Moab and felt that there could be asylum there, and he did. And the king of Moab let them stay there, and then David went back to Judah and went and stayed in a forest there, hid in a forest. All right? Well, meanwhile, Saul finds out about where David has been, that he had gone to Nob and gotten some help from Ahimelech. We see that in chapter 22, verse 9. I'll start at verse 6. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul's spear in his hand was seated under the tamarisk tree at the hill of Gibeah, with all his officials standing around him. Saul said to them, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give all of you fields and vineyards, like I do? Okay. Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, like I have? Is that why you've conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today." Okay, so you see his paranoia here, and he's griping at his commanders and leaders for potential treason, for protecting David, for not standing against David for him. "Nobody's on my side here," he's saying. But Doeg, the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's official, said, "I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, at Nob. Ahimelech acquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath the Philistine." Okay, so Saul finds out about David's visit to Nob because Doeg tells him. So we then see that the king, Saul, sends for the priest Ahimelech and his whole family, who are the priests at Nob, and they all come to the king. Saul says, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." "Yes, my lord," he answered. Saul said, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword, inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today?" Okay, so here he's being accused of consorting with the enemy here, being an enemy of Saul because he's being an ally of David. Ahimelech answered the king, "Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household?" Okay, I don't know what you're talking about. David being your enemy? He's the most loyal one out there. And besides, was that day the only day that... was that the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing about this whole affair. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay? Yes, I did inquire of God for him. I don't know what you're talking about him being your enemy and all that. I've inquired of God for him many times. So, did this explanation satisfy Saul? The king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family." Then the king ordered the guards at his side, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me." But the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. You see, this paranoia has gotten so great that he's going to kill anybody that has anything to do with David. And even the priests, the high priests, okay, and he commands the people to his soldiers there and his officials to kill the high priest and the high priest's family. But they're not going to. Okay? They refuse to do so because these are God's people. Okay? These are God's representatives here. So how was Saul able to get rid of these evil priests? Verse 18. The king then ordered Doeg, "You turn and strike down the priests." So Doeg the Edomite turned. He's from Edom. Okay, he's not an Israelite, so he doesn't have a whole lot of concern about the Israelites' God and their priests. Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob, the whole town of Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. It wasn't just enough to kill Ahimelech, the only one who had seen David. He killed everybody, the whole town, all the family, everybody. Remember what God had said to Eli about what that his family would live short lives and be victims of the sword. Here we see some of that being fulfilled. He has it totally destroyed. The whole town's destroyed. Everybody is killed, but not just everybody, the cattle, the sheep, the donkeys. Why did he do that? And contrast that when he was commanded to do it, back when he was commanded to go and totally wipe out the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15, he doesn't. He keeps the good cattle, sheep, and donkeys. But now, when it's his own jealousy and his own ego that's at stake here, he has everything killed. Well, David eventually learns what happens. How does he find out? Verse 20. But Abiathar, a son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, "Oh, that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he was sure to tell Saul, 'I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family.' Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who is seeking your life is seeking mine also. You'll be safe with me." Okay? So Abiathar was the sole survivor. He escaped, and he went to David. Well, if he's the whole sole survivor of the high priest family, what does that make him? That makes him the high priest. And he brought the ephod with him, and the Urim and Thummim, and you know the stuff that you use to inquire of God. Well, one thing that's not really pointed out here, but here in this chapter, you've got the three key elements of God's kingdoms. Okay, you've got the king, David, or the king-to-be. You've got, back in verse 5, the prophet, Gad, is with David. And now, we have the high priest, Abiathar, with David. We have the great prophet, priests, and kings together here, which foreshadows the great prophet, the great priest, the great king, who came once and for all, Jesus Christ. What other response did David have for this incident? Well, let's turn back to Psalm 52. What else is a musician going to do? Let's write a song. Okay, verse 52, or chapter 52. We'll just read verses 7 to 9. You can see in chapter 52 that this psalm was one that David wrote when Doeg the Edomite had gone to Saul and told him that David has gone out to the house of Ahimelech. Okay. And some verses, he says, "Here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others." Talking about Saul here. "But I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. I will praise you forever for what you've done. In your name I will hope, for your name is good. I will praise you in the presence of your saints." He writes a song to God. Were David and his men entirely focused on hiding from Saul? Okay, they're running from Saul. They're trying to find strongholds, places where they can hide safely from Saul. Well, chapter 23. When David was told, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, and they're looting the threshing floors." So David inquired of Yahweh, saying, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines?" The Lord answered, "Yes, go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah." So David and his men went to Keilah, fought the Philistines, and carried off their livestock. He inflicted heavy losses on the Philistines and saved the people of Keilah. Okay? So now that he's got the great high priest with him, Abiathar, he then goes to Abiathar and inquires of God, "Okay, I see what's going on over here. Does God want me to go fight the Philistines?" And the answer is yes. And in fact, the men get a little nervous of that, and so he asks again, and he says, "Yes, go, and I'll give you victory." And he goes, and he has this victory against the Philistines, and he saves Keilah. Okay, so now we're not talking about them just running away from Saul. He's being responsible for providing protection for the Israelites as well, that he's got these fighting men. How does Saul respond when he hears that David rescued Keilah from the Philistines? Okay, does he get on David's side finally again? Verse 7, Saul was told that David had gone to Keilah, and he said, "Ah, God has handed him over to me, for David has imprisoned himself by entering a town with gates and bars." So Saul called up all his forces for battle to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. What kind of reaction is that? David and his men just saved one of the towns of the Israelites, and Saul didn't even care about that. He sees this as a great opportunity to go get David because David is inside of a town. And all we have to do is go besiege that town, kill everybody in it, and that means it will kill David. You know, what deranged mind does this guy have? You know, sounding kind of like Saddam Hussein or Hitler or something. He just, his paranoia has gotten the worst of him here. Well, so did Saul catch David in Keilah? No, we kind of know the end of the story, so no, but let's look at that. Verse 13. Well, we'll kind of look ahead, okay? Or look before. When David learned that Saul was plotting against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod." Okay, I got to see what God wants me to do here. Okay? It's obvious. He probably needs to leave, right? But instead of doing the obvious, he inquires of God. And so he says, "God, I've heard for sure that Saul plans to come down to Keilah and destroy the town on account of me. Will the citizens of Keilah surrender him to me? Will Saul come down as I've heard? Oh, Lord God of Israel, tell me." And the Lord said, "He will." And again, David asked, "Will the citizens of Keilah surrender me and my men to Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will." So David and his men, about 600 in number, so it's grown from 400 to 600, left Keilah and kept moving from place to place. When Saul was told that David had escaped from Keilah, he did not go there. So you see that David again inquires of God when he hears about this threat. It's very clear from a human perspective what David should do, but David knows, you know, there's things that seem right in a man's eyes, but they're not right in God's eyes. So he inquires of God, and then he leaves. So Saul does not come and attack and besiege Keilah as he had planned. All right, another dumb question here. To whom did David turn during this time of hiding and trouble? Okay, well, let's look at a couple of Psalms. He obviously turned to God. Psalm 63 is one of the Psalms here. When he was in the desert of Judah. "Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water." So he's in the desert here. Verses 7 and 8. "Because you are my help, I will sing in the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me." And then Psalm 142. We see that this is a song of David when he was in the cave. Okay, he was in a few different caves, but that would fit with here. "I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out my complaint before him. Before him, I tell him my trouble. When my spirit grows faint within me, it is you who know my way. It is in the path where I walk. Men have hidden a snare for me. Look to my right and see. No one's concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares for me. So I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Listen to my cry, for I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they're too strong for me. Set me free from my prison, that I may praise your name. Then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me." Okay? So you see his songs, he turns to God. Turns to God for protection, for help, for strength, because he knows that God is in control of the situation. Okay? While he's there in desperation, hiding from Saul, Saul finds out where he is. But someone comes to see him. Verse 15. While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son, Jonathan, went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. And this is that verse that we read earlier. "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel. I'll be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." So the two of them then made another covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. So God sent Jonathan to comfort and to console David and to show David that God is there for you. God has this plan for you. There's nothing that my dad can do, no matter what he tries, to stop God's plan from carrying out. And I'm on your side. I'm with you. You'll become king because that's God's plan. I'll work with you. Well, Saul, meanwhile, hears that where David is. So what does he do? Well, the Ziphites, this is, you know, he's in the desert of Ziph. So the people who live there in the desert of Ziph went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Isn't David hiding among us in the stronghold at Horesh on the hill of Hakalah south of Jeshimon? Now, O king, come down whenever it pleases you, to do so, and we will be responsible for handing him over to the king. So the people of the desert of Ziph see this as an opportunity to get on the king's good side. We got him here. Let's go tell Saul and tell him we'll deliver him for him. Okay? So David finds out, Saul finds out where David is. Does Saul accept his help? Saul says, God bless you for your concern for me. Go and make further preparation. Find out where David usually goes and who's seen him there. They tell me he's pretty crafty. Find out all about his hiding places that he uses and come back to me with definite information. Then I'll go with you. If he's in the area, I'll track him down among all the caves of Judah. Okay, so he says, okay, thanks for your offer. I appreciate your help. Go and find out, spy him out, get all the intelligence information you can. Come back and tell me what you learn about his comings and goings and how he operates, and then that'll help us track him down. Okay? Well, how did David feel when he heard that these men were helping Saul? Well, Psalm 54. We'll just look at verses 3 to 5. My thoughts answer me, and I'm just... Whoops, I'm sorry. Strangers are attacking me. Ruthless men seek my life. Men without regard for God. Surely God is my help. The Lord is the one who sustains me. Okay? So he turns to God for help in this psalm, knowing that God will deliver him. God will protect him against these evil men, against these men who are conspiring to turn him over to Saul to be killed. So how does God deliver David when Saul's forces know where he is? They come in, they go to close in, and these people set out with Saul, ahead of Saul. And Saul and his men began the search. When David was told about it, he went down to the rock and stayed in it. When Saul heard that, he went to pursue David. And then, verse 26, Saul was going along one side of the mountain, and David and his men were on the other side, hurrying to get away from Saul. As Saul and his forces were closing in on David and his men to capture them, a messenger came to Saul saying, "Come quickly, the Philistines are raiding the land." Then Saul broke off his pursuit of David and went to meet the Philistines. That's why they call this place Sela Hamalakoth. And David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Sela Hamalakoth means rock of parting. Okay, so they parted ways there. So just as Saul was about to get his target, to get his prey, the Philistines attack, word comes to Saul, and he, as king and protector of Israel, goes and saves Israel from the Philistines. Thereby God saving David. All right. Well, then later, you know, David goes to En-Gedi, which is a beautiful oasis down by the Dead Sea. And David lives in the strongholds of En-Gedi there. Eventually, Saul returns from pursuing the Philistines, and he's told in verse 1 of chapter 24, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men. Okay, David's got 600 men. 3,000 chosen men, really good warriors from all of Israel, and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Now, while he was there, he came to the sheep pens along the way, and a cave was there. So Saul went in, used it as a porta potty. Okay, David and his men were far, but they just happened to be far back in the back of the cave. The men said to David, "Ah, this is the day that the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now that phrase that the men say there, we don't ever see that in the Bible. But it was known that David was going to be king. God was on his side. God would protect him. David goes up, and you see he gets so close to Saul. How can he cut off the corner of Saul's robe if he's not right there? So he sneaks up quietly and cuts off the corner of Saul's robe to prove that he was there. Okay. So why didn't David take this opportunity to kill Saul? Saul's trying to kill him. David is spending all his focus on trying to keep from being killed by Saul. God's delivered him in his hands, right? God's given David the opportunity to kill Saul. Why didn't David take that opportunity? Verse 5. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. Not only would David not kill Saul, he felt real guilty and real bad about cutting off the corner of Saul's robe. He said to the men, "Yahweh forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, because he's the anointed of the Lord." With these men, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And so Saul left the cave and went on his way. Okay, none the wiser, not realizing what David had done. So you see David's respect for God and God's choice, even though Saul was David's greatest enemy, he was still the Lord's anointed. And David refused to harm him, because if something's going to happen to him, God will make it happen to him. It's not my position to do something to Saul. Okay. Well, David then, and you've got these next verses here, that David comes out of the cave and calls out to Saul, "My Lord, the king." And Saul turns around and looks and, "Oh, David, what's going on?" David bows down and prostrates himself to the ground. He said, "Why do you listen when men say that I'm bent on harming you? Today, I had the opportunity to kill you, and I didn't do it. I will not lift up my hand against my master, because you're the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to harm you in any way. I had the chance today, and look, here is the corner of your robe. I cut it off. It shows you that I was right there, and I had the chance to kill you, but I won't do that. So don't feel that I'm your enemy. I'm not trying to kill you." And Saul's response to that, let's see, verse 16. "When David finished saying this, Saul said, 'Is that your voice, David, my son?' And then it hits him, and he realizes what's going on here. And Saul weeps aloud. He says, 'You're more righteous than I. You've treated me well, but I've treated you badly. You've just now told me of the good thing you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him go away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way that you treated me today. I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. It's God's will. God's going to make it happen. I know that's going to happen. Now, swear to me, by God, that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." Okay? "You've made it clear to me that you're not going to hurt me. You're not going to take the kingdom from me, because God's anointed me. So I'm safe. And I know that God's going to make you king. But swear to me that you're not going to go and kill off my family, that you'd be nice to my family, to my descendants." Okay? And so David gave his oath to Saul, verse 22. Then Saul returned home, and David and his men went back to their stronghold. Okay? Because Saul's fluctuated before, right? He's sworn to God that he wasn't going to hurt David, and then next day he goes and tries to kill him again. Okay? So David and his men go back to the stronghold. Chapter 25 is a long chapter that we don't have time to look at, and a very interesting story. Really, it's kind of you see a lot of parallels in there. It's a story of Nabal, which is a guy whose name means fool. Nabal means fool, okay? And his wife Abigail. And I'll just let you read that story. And when you do read that story, take a look at Nabal and how he compares with Saul. You know, from his manner, his way of dealing with other people, his response to David's protection, and David, where David is good to Nabal and his household, likewise David's good to Saul and his household. But what's Nabal's reaction to that, just like Saul's reaction? And then how does God deal with Nabal in comparison to how does God deal with Saul? And then also you can see comparisons between the righteousness or the righteous way of response of Abigail, Nabal's wife, and David. And then we end up seeing at the end of the chapter there too that Abigail and David become married. So interesting story. I'll let you look at it on your own. All right. Then time passes. And then chapter 26, the Ziphites go to Saul at Gibeah again and say, "Isn't David hiding on the hill of Hakalah, which faces Jeshimon?" In other words, he's back in the same place again. Well, even though Saul had sworn that he wasn't going to do anything to David, he's changed his mind again. Verse 2, "So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David." Okay, so the Ziphites go again. Ziphites, by the way, they're the descendants of Caleb's grandson Ziph. Okay. Caleb, you remember, is one of the 12 spies, one of the two that said that they should have gone in to the promised land. Caleb was given some land in Judah, in the southern part of Israel. All right, what did David do then when Saul and his troops camped near where David was hiding? Okay. Well, David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. David had sent scouts out and found where Saul and his people were. And so David went down there one night, and he saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had laid down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. Of course, you protect the king. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, who was Joab's brother, "Who will go down to the camp with me to Saul?" "I'll go with you," said Abishai. Abishai and Joab. Joab was David's commander-in-chief. And we'll see a whole lot more about Joab in coming weeks. So Abishai, his brother, says, "I'll go with you." And so they went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. So very well protected, all these people around him, but everybody's sleeping. And we've already seen David can be pretty quiet. Abishai said to David, "Look, today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice. It won't take twice. I won't have to take two shots." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he'll die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now, let's get the spear and the water jug that are near his head, and let's go." So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because God was involved. He had put them into a deep sleep. Okay, so he has another opportunity to kill Saul, but he does not take it. That's the furthest thing from his mind. There's no way that he's going to raise his hand or not just kill, but even injure or harm or think evil of the Lord's anointed. God has chosen him. If God wants him to no longer be around or be king, God will make that happen. So he grabs a spear, he grabs his water jar, and then he gets outside the camp, goes a distance away here, and he crosses over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill some distance away, and there was a wide space between them. He couldn't stay right there in the camp because they could capture him and kill him. He has to be a little distance here. He calls out to the army, to Abner, the commander of the army, son of Ner. "Abner, Abner, aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" Abner replies, "Who are you who calls to the king?" David said, "You're a man, aren't you? And who's like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master." That's your role, is to guard the Lord's anointed, and you didn't do it. "Look around you. Where are the king's spear and his water jug that were near his head?" Okay. So he kind of raises the flag and he complains to Abner for being such a lousy guard of the Lord's anointed. Okay. So how does Saul respond to this? Going on, Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" "Yes, it is, my lord and king. Why is the Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What am I guilty of? Now, let the Lord my king listen to his servant's word. If God's incited you against me, well, then let him accept an offering instead of killing me. If, however, men have done it, may they be cursed before God. They've now driven me away from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve other gods.' Don't let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of God. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." And it all hits Saul again. Saul says, "Oh, I've sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely, I've acted like a fool, and I've erred greatly." Okay. And so David says, here's a spear. Come, have somebody come get it. And Saul says to David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph." And then David went on his way, and Saul returned home. So Saul was confronted again with his sin against David and against God and against David's righteousness. And faced with that, he confessed his sin, repented of his sin, and turned and went home and stopped pursuing David, at least for this time. Okay. All right, chapter 27. Well, David knows Saul well enough. He's sworn that he's not going to kill David. He's not going to chase David anymore. But you know what? He forgets those things real easy, doesn't he? He's kind of an Indian giver on some of those things. So, I got to get out of here. I got to go somewhere where Saul is not going to pursue me anymore. So where does he go? Chapter 27. David thought to himself, one of these days, I'm going to be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel. I'll slip out of his hand. Okay? So let me go to the Philistines. And so he goes with the 600 men to Achish. Okay, same guy, the king of Gath. And now he's not insane. Okay? And he's got all these men with him. But word has gotten out, and it's clear. You know, this guy's been here before, escaping Saul. Saul, the king of Israel, is trying to kill him. An enemy of Saul is an enemy of my, is a friend of mine, is the approach that he takes. So David and his men settled in Gath with Achish, and each man had his family with him. When Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, verse 4, he no longer searched for him. So what David was doing accomplished its means. Did David have to act insane to be accepted this time? Verse 12. Achish trusted David and said to himself, he's become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant forever. So Achish trusted David because he's clearly an enemy of Saul. He's clearly an enemy of the Israelites. And David did some things to reinforce this. It's kind of interesting to see what he did. Starting at verse 8. David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. These are people south of Philistia. They're not Philistines, they're not Israelites, they're some of the other Canaanites. And he and his men would go and raid these people. From ancient times, these people had lived in the land extending to Shur in Egypt, so they're further south there. Whenever David attacked an area, he did not leave a man or woman alive. But he took all the good stuff. He took the sheep and the cattle and the donkeys and the camels and their clothes. And he returned to Achish. When Achish asked, where did you go raiding today? David would say, oh, against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of Jerahmeel, or against the Negev of the Kenites. He did not leave a man or woman alive to be brought to Gath, for he thought that might they might inform on us and say, this is what David did. And that was his practice as long as he lived in Philistine territory. So David and his men, well, this kept their fighting skills strong, but they went out and they attacked these other Canaanites. Canaanites that the Israelites had not finished off. Gerzites and Geshurites and Amalekites, some of the Amalekites that were still out there. But when they came back, they didn't tell Achish that that's what they had done. He said, we've been raiding Israelite towns. We've been killing the Israelites. Okay? And there you see verse 12. Achish goes, man, the Israelites hate him so much. He's become so odious. This guy's going to be, he's going to be my friend forever. Okay? And Achish shows his acceptance of David. We see in verses 6 and 7, it says that Achish gave him Ziklag, which was a Philistine town. So he gave him property there in Philistia. And that Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in Philistine territory a year and 4 months. So he was there for a good while and settled, and all the men settled there, and they had this town called Ziklag. On top of that, giving Ziklag to David, we see at the beginning of chapter 28 that in those days the Philistines gathered their forces to fight against Israel. Okay? And David, an Israelite in Philistine land, but again, verse 12, the Philistines believe that David is a complete enemy to the Israelites. Achish said to David, now, you've been seeking asylum here in my land. You must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army. And David said, then you will see for yourself what your servant can do. Achish replied, very well then, I'll make you my bodyguard for life. So Achish trusted David so much that he was going to bring him into battle against the Israelites. Have David come fight the Israelites. Now you see the kind of double meaning response that that David gives. He says, ah, then you'll see for yourself what I can do. Okay. So Achish takes that David is going to fight against the Israelites, but David knows better. Was Achish really comfortable with the idea of having David join the battle against the Israelites? Chapter 29. We see that the Philistines gather their forces at Aphek, and Israel is camped by the spring at Jezreel, so they're forming battle lines here. As the Philistine rulers marched with their units of hundreds and thousands, David and his men were marching at the rear with Achish. The commanders of the Philistines asked, "What about these Hebrews?" Achish said, "Well, isn't this David, who is an officer of Saul, king of Israel? What's he doing here with us?" Achish said, "He's already been with me for over a year now, and from the day that he left Saul until now, I found no fault with him." But the Philistine commander said, "Send him back. We don't trust him." So they sent him back. And we'll look more at that story next week. But Achish was fine. He trusted David. But the Philistine commanders didn't trust him and didn't want him. Okay? So we'll leave David in Philistine territory today. And next week we'll pick back up and take the story off from there. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us. We thank you for showing us David's faithfulness and his trust in you. When his life was at risk for so many years, he trusted you. Even when you gave him opportunities to take matters into his own hands and eliminate the threat by killing Saul, he wouldn't take that. He left that in your hands. He trusted you for that. Every time he ran into a brick wall, every time he ran into a time of trouble, he called on you. We have a whole book of Psalms as a result of that. We thank you for his example of faithfulness, of trust in you. Help us to use your Spirit to gain the strength and to put our trust in you when we have difficult times, just as David did. Help us to use his example in our own lives. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.